This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. As the Democratic-controlled Congress prepares to pass President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package, a sticking point in the negotiations is an amendment that would gradually raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2025. That would more than double the current federal minimum wage of $7.25, where it has sat since 2009. Progressive caucus members such as Washington Representative Pramila Jayapal and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders are pushing hard for the amendment, even as their Republican counterparts say that a raise to the minimum wage during an economic downturn is a non-starter. However, Democrats may still succeed in passing the amendment by a simple majority through the process of reconciliation. A recent poll by the Quinnipiac University found that 61% of Americans would support such a move by Congress. So today, we air a pre-pandemic panel on if, when, and how we should raise the minimum wage, as well as its benefits and risks to the economy. The panel includes Mark Nold, chief economist at the Utah Department of Workforce Services; Marshall Steinbaum, assistant professor of economics at the University of Utah; and Juliette Tenner, director of economic and public policy research at the Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute. Moderating today's panel is Representative Brian King, House Minority Leader in the Utah Legislature. This forum was put on in partnership with the University of Utah's Economics Department. This forum was recorded on October 31st, 2019. Here is your moderator, Representative Brian King.
Thank you. Brian King's my name, as we were introduced. I'm also proud to tell you I am an economics, I have an economics major from the University of Utah, and this is the place, right? So to get started, we're going to turn some time over to Mark Nold, who is the chief economist at the Utah Department of Workforce Services, to present some slides to talk to us about some of the things that he's got here. So Mark, I give you that time to do that.
Okay, thank you. Let's take a little bit of time to just look at the national landscape in regards to the minimum wage. So you could have a look here at the slide that's up there. If you're a state that is in white, you either have the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, or you don't even have a minimum wage level. You can see a few states there with red dots, like Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, and so on. They have no official minimum wage of their own, a state minimum wage mandated within their laws. Now, more than likely, they adhere to the federal minimum wage, but, you know, a state like Utah, on the other hand, its laws say that the minimum wage is the federal minimum law. There's a couple of states, I think Georgia and Wyoming, that actually have state minimum wage laws lower than the $7.25 an hour. We'll talk about how states can have such a thing. Then the yellow ones would be up to $9.50 an hour. Orange has minimum wage somewhere up to $11 an hour, and the ones over red would be anywhere from $11 to $15 an hour. Now, there's a lot of nuances that go on within the states. Some states have minimum wage levels where the different rates apply for employer sizes. So smaller employers have this wage level, and larger employers have to meet this wage level. And oftentimes, well, what's that based on? Sometimes it's based upon the number of employees. So it would be by employment size. Sometimes it's based upon the gross annual sales that a company does. And so some states will have the employer minimums, and some states have sales minimums. The implementation of state mandated increases could be implemented on a slower time or pay scale for smaller employers. So some states, if you see states in here with arrows pointing at them, that is saying here's currently where their minimum wage laws are, but they have on the books that it is inching up as time goes on various kinds of scales. If it's a red arrow, they have passed laws that will eventually get them to $15 minimum wage levels. If they have a green arrow, they have laws that will get them to some other level below $15 an hour, but it is working its way up to a higher wage level. And again, some states have will make larger employers get to that level faster than smaller employers will. That's written in some of those laws. This one was interesting. Illinois offered a tax credit to employers with less than 50 full-time employees. And so it can only be claimed if the average wage for employees making $55,000 or less increases over the year. The percentage an employer can claim decreases with time. So it's saying that, okay, all employers are going to this level, but if you're a certain type of an employer, we'll give you a tax credit to offset it. Nevada had an interesting one. $825 is the minimum without health benefits, but if the employer offers health benefits, then it's $725. Oklahoma, certain size and sales of employers are subject to the federal minimum wage. Others are subject to the state minimum wage of $2 an hour. Oregon had different minimums for employers located in the urban growth boundary, and it had lower rates for employers located in its non-urban counties. Missouri, Oklahoma, Texas, Utah, Virginia exclude from coverage any employment that is subject to the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act. And in Georgia, employees covered by the Fair Labor Standards Act paid federal minimum. If you're not covered, the state minimum is $515. When it says that you're not covered and so on, oftentimes they're talking about the tipping industry. And waiters, waitresses, bartenders, and so on. But what the law usually says is, look, you can pay them $5.15 an hour, but their tips, when you report your tips, it has to equal at least $7.25 an hour or more. If their tipping doesn't get them to that level, then the employer has to pay them to get them up to that kind of a level. So there's a lot of nuances and so on that go on across the United States in terms of the minimum wage levels, the states and so on, and some cities and geographic areas inside of states are have their own movements and so on within the minimum wage. New York State has geographical minimum wages and so on. One thing with the federal minimum wage, this is kind of a history of it. The dark blue is the nominal value of the minimum wage, and the lighter blue is the real cost or real gain, so to speak, in terms of 2019 dollars. It peaked out at 1968, where a $1 and probably 85 cent minimum wage in today's terms would be almost equal to $12 an hour. I guess the point of this is, as time has gone on and you go out to the end of that graphic there, that the basic $7.25 minimum wage is equal to the real, you know, like all the real gains have been eroded away. That at $7.25 basically equals $7.25 in today's dollars and so on. And this you know, real gains and so on, that the oomph that really comes from the minimum wage has really eroded away. Now, what about here in Utah? I took the Census Bureau's PUMS data. So there's the American Community Survey that's done every year. And they have the micro data that's inside of there. And the most recent is 2017. So if you break it into wage groupings here, you can kind of see quantification of people in Utah. Now, this is probably, I guess there's probably a bit of a movement to the right on this scale from 2017 till now, because in the last couple of years, we've have seen much more aggressive wage activity and wage growth going on in the state than we had prior to the 2017. That was really the to a large degree, still the question mark on this side of the Great Recession and that shadow is where were the wage gains? Because what I'm saying is as the unemployment rate comes down and down and down, historically that the wage rates will go up, up, and up. It's like an inverse relationship, and it's a strong inverse relationship that as unemployment falls, then your wage growth is going to go up because the concept is you have less and less people available, idle and working, and you have to start bidding more for labor, and therefore the wage prices are going to go up. PUMS stands for Public Use Micro System or Statistics or something. It's the actual individuals, people's answers confidentially covered up. And so this PUMS data is what's available to put us into wage categories and classifications. Now, if you were going to raise the minimum wage to $10.25 an hour here in the state of Utah based on that PUMS data, you would be moving 14.5% of the labor force up to meet that wage mandate or wage gain. $12 an hour, you're almost up to 25% of the entire labor force. And if you were going to go to $15 minimum, over one-third of all the workers would need to be moved, whether it's immediately or with time, up to $15 an hour. Now, another thing to always think in mind with this, if you're moving people from a lower category up to a higher category, and here's where you're going to put them, what about the people that were already there or just barely above it? In other words, at some point in time, I'm $4 above the minimum wage, and they move it up, and now I'm only 50 cents above. There's compression to move it forward. So it's not just moving the minimum wage, it's moving the whole scale to a point where when does it stop being impacted or pushed? And finally, another thing to keep in mind is when cities do minimum wage levels, that's not equality across all levels. So in other words, a $15 an hour in Seattle equals about $9.90 an hour here. New York, Brooklyn, $15 an hour is equal to $8.45 here in terms of cost of living. So you make these cost of living adjustments. So the thought or the idea of going to $15 an hour at the federal minimum wage level was definitely going to hit certain areas much differently than it's going to hit other areas based upon cost of living.
That was Mark Nold, chief economist at the Utah Department of Workforce Services. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety as a public service. Today, we are airing a panel discussion on the proper role of the minimum wage in our economy. Here again is your moderator, Representative Brian King.
Here's a question that I have for the three of you out of the gate. We hear talk about the minimum wage, and you've done a good job explaining that, Mark. What is a living wage? We hear talk about a living wage, too. If you could, each of you, or it doesn't need to be each of you that address this, but if you could tell us what the distinction between those two concepts is.
I can jump in on living wage. And it's really, I think, you know, all of you in this room, you're interested in this issue. We've got a lot of econ students in the room. So I think that you intuitively get this, right? But it's very important to make the distinction between minimum wage and a living wage. So, and it would be, you know, if the policy intervention of a minimum wage is appropriate, and we'll probably talk about what that means, then, you know, thinking about what the actual living wage is really important. So a living wage would be a wage that allows an individual worker to actually like achieve whatever they need to achieve. You know, there's some basic amount of housing that everyone needs. There's some basic amount of transportation, food, medical care. And so as economists, when we're advising policymakers, we need to understand for any given region or location, and Mark kind of makes this point as he shows you the differences in regions, we need to think about, okay, what is the living wage for that region? And that, I mean, even if we're talking about Utah, a living wage in Salt Lake County is different than a living wage in Daggett County.
Yeah, it goes into the cost of living issues.
Exactly, exactly. MIT has a really nice calculator that you guys should check out on this. And so it actually goes through and does some calculations. And, you know, you can kind of go in and kind of think about, okay, does what they've identified as kind of a minimum need for housing, does that jive with what our thinking is? But it's a nice calculator. And I wrote down some of those numbers before I came in just to give you an idea of what's coming out of the calculator. And it depends on your family size too, right? So if you're a single individual, just taking care of yourself, in order to meet all of your housing, transportation, medical care, in Salt Lake County, it's about $12 an hour. If you are a single parent with two kids, or three kids, it could be $40 an hour. So there's a lot of variation in what that means. But again, it's being able to support all of those basic
needs. So Juliet, would it be accurate to say that the living wage takes into account variations in cost of living from place to place? Or what is it more sensitive to the circumstances at issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think it should be. So again, a living wage should be what type of income does it take to support a certain standard of living? And that varies between regions.
Right.
Marshall, do you have any?
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. So here's another question. One of the things that I think is important for us to have an explicit discussion of is what's the purpose? I mean, you alluded, Juliet, to the purpose being able to make ends meet in a reasonable way. So how does that work in terms of the bigger society and the dynamic forces, economic forces at play? In terms of if you put a minimum wage in place, what's the effect in terms of shutting down business, for example, or, you know, causing some employers to say, well, then I can't stay open if I have to pay my employees that much? Talk to us a little bit about the dynamic there.
Sure. I think that's a great question about what the purpose of the minimum wage is, because I believe there's a lot of ambiguity about that in the public discussion. There is certainly the question of, you know, is it possible to support a family or to support yourself by working at the minimum wage? That's kind of what the idea of the living wage is getting to. I think there's also a broader discussion about the minimum wage as a egalitarian policy, so a remedy for rising inequality. And I think some of the data that we have showing the effect of the minimum wage, both for the people who earn it and elsewhere in the wage distribution, so people who earn maybe a little bit more than the minimum wage, would they get an increase in wages, you know, shows that it does have some egalitarian effect. But, you know, the rise in inequality is a much broader phenomenon than just the stagnation of wages or decline in real wages at the bottom of the wage distribution. And I don't think it's likely that the minimum wage by itself would act in an egalitarian way. I think the element of the argument or the rationale for minimum wage that's getting more attention recently is that it is a mechanism for ensuring or protecting against exploitation in the labor market, that in the employer-employee relationship, employers have power to dictate wages and working conditions, and they can potentially impose reductions in the quality of a job in exchange for wages, or even, you know, impose both a reduction in the quality of a job and a wage reduction. And the piece of the minimum, the role that the minimum wage plays in a kind of employer-employee bargaining position is that it creates a floor below which workers cannot be pushed, at least if they were, the boss would potentially face legal repercussions. And in that context, it gives workers a better basis on which to negotiate a position for themselves vis-a-vis their employer.
So do you all three think that the minimum wage is an effective tool, tying into what you were just saying, Marshall? Is it an effective tool in addressing, I mean, there are a number of things that it's designed to address, but for this purpose of talking about wage inequality and income inequality, is it just part of a much bigger analysis of how we affect that, or is it, in your opinion, not really an effective tool at all for various reasons?
I guess we could all speak to that. I'll just give my two cents first. My view is that it is a very effective tool. That is, all the reasons that had been put forward to believe that it has adverse consequences for the people that it's intended to help, that it creates an insider-outsider dynamic in the labor market, so the people who remain employed do better because their wage may go up when the minimum wage goes up, but the people who would otherwise be employed in the absence of a minimum wage can't find a job. And so there's sort of this distinction between who gets a job and who doesn't get a job. Those concerns have been tested and, in my view, put to rest. So as I was saying before, the minimum wage is not a panacea for rising inequality or wage stagnation throughout the middle class. And I do think we need to develop other policy agenda to address those things. I think the idea that it is counterproductive has not really borne fruit empirically.
You agree with that, Juliet? Mark?
Well, let Mark go, and then I'll tell you my two cents.
Sure. Again, it's not the panacea, it's not the answer, but it is what it says it is. It's a minimum. It's a minimum wage. It's a minimum effort to make some kind of social activity in the labor market to at least put that floor on the wage levels. And I think there's also another discussion that could happen as to, well, what's the philosophical approach of what we as society, or even political parties within the societies, want to do with the minimum wage. The minimum wage right now, the actual one, is much higher than $7.25. So when you have a very low unemployment rate and you're bidding for workers, the reality is that the minimum wage is much higher. I mean, you can go to Arby's, $12 an hour, $13 an hour, you see it on the signs and so on. So if you have a philosophical idea that, well, the minimum wage should be as little disruptive as possible in the labor market, the best time to raise it is when the real market has already done it. So you just come in and put that base in there underneath it, so that when the economy might go into a recession or some slowdown and the wage pressures back off, it doesn't fall back down to a very low level. It hits that bottom. There are others, though, who might want to look at the minimum wage as some kind of a social action thing where, okay, that minimum wage, the real one is at $12, but we should reach down and pull it to 15. We should get it to a higher level. We should be proactive in this whole thing and go beyond what the market itself is going to do. So there's that kind of discussions that go with the minimum wage. Do we make it more aggressive than what the market is, or do we try and keep it as impactful less as possible and just come in underneath where the real labor market is at, or where the real wage levels are, and just put that new bottom on it?
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I kind of, good economist on one hand, on the other hand, agree with both of my colleagues on either side of me. And it really, like, I think a lot about, okay, is a minimum wage effective? Is it appropriate? It goes back to what the objective of the minimum wage is. And so, again, my colleague Marshall makes the point that it's potentially a great tool for addressing exploitation. So if we assume that very low skill, low wage workers do not have the ability to transfer jobs easily, negotiate easily, then that might be an appropriate intervention to help them. If we're worried about income inequality and quality of life and making sure that people have the incomes that they need to live well, minimum wage would be one intervention. I like to think about what other potential interventions would be. We do worry about distortions in the market. Like, I think about distortions, and, you know, the empirical evidence does suggest that it's not, especially, like, you know, the markets just aren't perfect. Labor markets aren't perfect. So the empirical evidence does suggest that maybe we don't need to be as worried about shrinking the employment base as maybe the theory would have you believe. But some of the research does show that on the very, very low end, very, very low skill, low hours workers, that a minimum wage might push those people out. And so, right, because all of a sudden, if XYZ job needs to pay $15 an hour, they're going to want to have, I mean, you're going to want to have a higher skilled worker in that $15 an hour job. And so you can actually, again, we worry about the lowest skilled workers. And so, you know, you need to think about additional policy interventions in terms of educational opportunity, a really strong safety net. Something like an earned income tax credit or even a basic income might be less distortionary than potentially the minimum wage.
Thank you. I want to ask this question. You alluded to it in your response, your comments, Juliet. What's the empirical evidence show about the extent to which raising the minimum wage has damaged business activity or entrepreneurial activity? I think that's the thing that we hear about. You know, I remember Seattle, I don't know, was it 2 or 3 years ago, put in place a $15 minimum wage. And there was lots of talk about how this was going to really damage the economy up in that area. Has that proven out?
Yeah, and I'd love for Marshall to answer this because I know that he's, you know, the academic who's in the middle of all this research. But we have work from Alan Krueger, who's just passed away, right, from years and years ago, that have tested this and have not necessarily seen employment or the workforce on total shrink, unemployment go up because of it. Again, I think about what happens on the margins, but in total, that's what Krueger's work shows us. And now we have this great experiment. We love these experiments where we see these large increases in the minimum wage in areas like Seattle. And so people like my friend to the right are thinking about what actually happens.
Yeah, so this has been a very interesting context in which to study the minimum wage's effect on employment and other aspects of the labor market, as you were alluding to. I think the Seattle case is a very interesting one because it's happened in stages. So basically, for every stage, you get a set of studies that come out that study the effect of that one increase. And in fact, you know, you can kind of study the effect on multiple different things. So it's given rise to a very rich literature studying this one policy intervention. And I think what that has shown is that the fear is that it was disemploying people that were below the new thresholds have been shown to be wrong, or at least it's more subtle than that. So there was a study that came out that when I think the wage was increased from $11 to $13, so as part of the progression up to $15, that showed a substantial disemployment effect on workers who were earning in those wage buckets. But as Mark was suggesting before, that kind of subsequent analysis really showed that it had a different, that was capturing something different because of the what was going on in the overall economy in Seattle, namely an economic expansion that was overall increasing wages. So what that study was actually picking up was that workers were moving from low wage buckets to higher wage buckets. And so that the authors of that study interpreted the reduction in the number of workers working in that low wage bucket area as a reduction in employment at those low wages, what happened was that people were sort of, both for minimum wage reasons, but also for other economic reasons, were kind of being put in higher and higher wage categories.
So it wasn't a negative thing at all. It was a positive thing.
It was showing overall positive effects. And then you could say that that's exactly the context in which you would want to raise the minimum wage for the reasons that Mark was saying. I just to sort of round up the discussion of Seattle, I think one of the interesting things that's starting to come out is changes in the distribution of types of businesses and types of establishments. So that's an economics-y type way of describing like a workplace that employ people. So what you get is a reallocation of employment from, in the case of the restaurant industry, from smaller like one or two establishment companies to larger chain restaurants. And so you could ask the question, well, you know, that's not necessarily a disemployment effect, but is that having an effect, is the minimum wage having an effect on the restaurant industry writ large in this area that, you know, is either good or bad? I mean, a lot of people in the labor literature would refer to high road and low road employers. And in this context, the chain restaurants would be a high road employer because they would have the capacity to employ people with a greater degree of higher wages and overall better benefits package, that sort of thing. And if the minimum wage effect is to put out of business the low road employers and expand the high road employers, you can interpret that as a very good development for low wage workers. But that might, I mean, you might take a different perspective on that kind of shift.
Mark, you have any thoughts on this?
Nothing that hasn't already been said in this regard.
Here's a question that I have. Is there anything that the research demonstrates is just pretty clearly a negative effect or a downside of increasing the minimum wage? I mean, does it lead to higher, less affordable housing, for example? I mean, are there things like that? That it is a complex picture, I'm sure. And is there anything that the empirical research demonstrates is something that is just, you from an economist's perspective, is not a good thing?
again, to reiterate what they were saying is that, you know, there's this concept, you know, on paper or in theory that this is what it's going to do. You know, you're going to raise the minimum wage. You're doing something the market doesn't want to do. Employers are going to react. They're the ones you're trying to help are the ones you're going to hurt because they're the ones who are being raised with the minimum wage. And the employer says, well, that they're not worth that anymore, and so on. And we've had a lot of minimum wage increases, and there really isn't any time period where you could have a paper that says this definitely hurt.
So is there a consensus, Mark, among economists on this? Because, listen, I don't know if you knew this, but I'm up at the Utah State Legislature. And people come to me when we talk about this, and they act like the research, the empirical studies, the evidence is very unsettled. And that there's a good argument to be made on either way. Is there a consensus among economists that the minimum wage does not lead to the loss of significant losses of jobs?
Is there ever a consensus among economists? So maybe one resource to point you to: the University of Chicago does this survey of, I don't know, what is it, like 50 economists or 100 economists of top economists, and they do it on a number of economic issues. And some issues they lean one way very much on. I can't think of one off the top of my head, but you can go through
tariffs.
That's a good one. Yeah, tariffs. Definitely go there. There's a relative consensus for economists. The minimum wage issue is actually it is much more mixed by that survey. And then you can go and you can look at, they'll be citing different empirical studies. I definitely will jump over. I'll pass the mic over. In terms of what I'd like to see studied more to understand, is it a sure good thing or obviously a negative thing? I think there's just mixed results. I'd like to think about, you know, total compensation and total quality of life. So when we implement an intervention of raising the minimum wage to $15, total income maybe rises. So that's what you need to look at that. But then what happens to insurance rates? You know, what happens to pension savings? Or, you know, so I kind of think about, like, you know, it's bigger. It's a bigger picture.
Well, let me flesh that out a little bit. Is what you're saying, Juliet, that if you require employers to pay more in the form of money, salary, or compensation, they may very well cut back on other fringe benefits, such as the generosity of the benefits that they provide in other ways? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. Potentially. I mean, if you have a budget, there's not a limitless amount of money in that budget. And so for individual employers making decisions about, there's profit taking going on, right? But, you know, making decisions about total compensation, potentially there could be erosion of benefits and such. And that's why I think it's interesting, because the empirical research does show us that on net, what we're seeing, I wouldn't interpret is that there's a negative impact on net, right? But then thinking about, you know, you're kind of thinking about what does it mean for individual employers, different types of employers, small employers versus large employers. There's different dynamics at play.
Yeah, I would say, so to speak to this question of what is the effect on housing costs, for example, I don't think that has been studied very much, or certainly not enough to be able to come to an answer and say that there's a consensus on one side or another. I think that kind of gets to the idea that, you know, the minimum wage takes up a lot of oxygen for good reason, I think, because we're debating, you know, the sort of structure of the labor market and who gets what, which is inherently a controversial issue. But in this respect, you know, kind of no increase in the minimum wage that's actually happened has probably had much of an effect on housing markets enough to really discern. So that's why it's hard to study, in the sense that, you know, people who earn the minimum wage are competing for housing in a market that has lots of other people looking for housing in it. And I would just be surprised, even in a case like Seattle, or San Francisco, where the increases have been substantial, is that really enough to discern some housing effect, especially when those markets, you know, the housing prices are already, you know, going up at a very high rate. So, like, what, you know, could you really figure out what the minimum wage is doing there?
Teasing out causation is hard. Yeah.
This dialogue we're doing right now is along the lines of, okay, if you change the minimum wage or raise it, What's its trickle effects? Yeah. What's its ripple effects into other parts of the economy? And that's getting back to my earlier comment that the best time to raise the minimum wage is when the market has already moved up and there is no ripple effects. It's already done it. So you just come in and put that, you raise the minimum wage to basically just underneath that, and there is no consequences because the market's already done its consequences. It's already, if there's any negatives that would go on with higher wage activities and so on, the employers have already factored it into their thinking. They've already accepted it. They've already moved it. So really the best time to move the minimum wage is when you're in these really tight labor markets and just come in and put a base on it, and you really don't have any additional economic ripple effects that move on through the economy.
Mark, to follow up on that question, do you see, in fact, what you just said happening in the country and in state legislatures across the country?
I think you probably, I had this map and it was showing a lot of different activities that were going on across the states. And as I was going over the chart and seeing the notes and stuff, much of that divergence of movements that have been going on through the states have really happened over the last couple of years. So you've gone to 725 in 2009 and not much happened. You're in the Great Recession. You come out of it, you start to get recovery going, and it's been about 2015, 2016, 2017, where some of these states are stepping up and saying, well, I'm going over and above what the federal minimum is because of whatever various reasons. And more than likely, they're getting away with doing it with no effects because the market's already been moving in that direction.
Marshall?
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thing in this question of unintended side effects. I don't know if this would fall in that category, but one important consideration to keep in mind is that the minimum wage is not self-enforcing. So you pass a law that says that it's illegal to pay somebody less than however many dollars an hour. It doesn't necessarily mean that everybody is actually going to get paid at least that amount. And you showed the wage distribution that basically started in according to the diagram that you showed at the minimum wage or just below it. In Utah, but there are people in Utah, I'm fairly certain, who make below $7.25 an hour, notwithstanding the fact that that's illegal. And in fact, research does show that when the minimum wage increases, wage theft gets worse. So people who are entitled to a higher wage don't actually get paid that amount. When you think that, it's an unintended side effect that this law doesn't have the consequence that we imagined it to have, well, that's because you actually have to enforce the law. And overall, I can't speak directly to minimum wage enforcement in Utah, but overall enforcement of labor regulations in general has been in substantial decline over the last 30 years. And I think you can see that in the ways that, for example, occupational industries injuries are getting more frequent.
And to take us down to the end of the spectrum on that, human trafficking issues are becoming more and more prominent as a concern. Juliet?
That is the concern. I didn't necessarily have anything to add.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. About 20 to 1. I want to leave some time for questions at about 1:45. I'd be interested in your perspectives about how the United States and the minimum wage and the living wage here compares to what has been done in other countries, developed countries, obviously, advanced countries, in terms of providing the kind of security and safety net for people who are working to maintain a standard of living that's livable.
Yeah, that's a great question, actually, because the minimum wage is a fairly internationally unusual policy, but it is getting more frequently adopted by other countries that previously did not have one. So the United States kind of led the way in enacting minimum wages in the progressive era at the state level and then ultimately at the federal level in the 1930s. Other countries relied more on what we might call sectoral bargaining. So that has, it's not a matter of law what people get paid, but it's a matter of negotiations between worker representatives and employer representatives. And those negotiations give rise to contracts that bind all workers in a given industry, regardless of whether they are members of the worker organization that arrived at that contract.
So it correlates, Marshall, to cut the chase, to stronger unions in other countries.
Yeah, and it's complicated to say whether unions are stronger, because in a country like Sweden, unions represent a tiny fraction of the workforce, and yet the contracts that they negotiate bind all the workers in the industry. So there's a more decentralized, or I should say at least non-legislative context to the establishment of wage floors in an industry, and that's what ends up determining people's wages. And there's wage scale, so it's like the minimum in this industry for the lowest qualified worker is this, and then for, you know, if you are at that job title, then your wage is this. And it's a much more structured type of labor market than we have here. In the United States, we kind of got started earlier, and the structure that was built up is less defined. So it's like you have a minimum, and then besides the minimum, you know, it's kind of totally individualized who gets what. The reason why other countries are actually moving more towards the U.S. model, despite the fact that the U.S. model is older, is because the set of workers whose wages and working conditions are governed by these centralized contracts is diminishing. So in a country like Germany, they adopted a bunch of reforms in the early 2000s that effectively created an alternative workforce that is not subject to the labor market regulations that had previously characterized the German economy. So they have a good chunk of the workforce now that is essentially unregulated. And as a kind of backstop to that creation of a dual-track labor force, those countries are adopting minimum wages that bind everybody. So you might think, okay, well, you know, you've still got the sectorally bargained people. They're not earning the minimum wage, and they're not really affected by this change in legislation. The people who are now no longer, you know, in the same industries, no longer protected by the same bargained contracts, they do now have a sort of backstop protection. Or I think in Germany, they actually have not adopted it. I'm not certain about that, but I think that it's a matter of current political debate whether to do so or not, exactly for this reason.
So let me make sure that I understand. Are you saying that in other countries there has been a diversification of industrial activity in a way that doesn't allow for organized labor, negotiated contract rates to benefit everyone in the same way that yeah. was going on 30 years ago, for
example? Yeah, so they've created a carve-out that you know, frankly, looks a lot like the United States, where certain employers and certain workers at those employers are not protected by the same longstanding centrally negotiated contracts as had been the case previously.
Okay, thank you. Juliet, Mark, other comments about international comparisons to the United States?
Oh, I'm definitely focused on Utah.
Well,
I should be paying attention more.
Mark, the Department of Workforce Services, yeah. You have to be focused on just something other than Utah, right?
But let me just make a point really quick. It's kind of off point, but I think that's what's so great about, you know, the University of Utah, having folks like Marshall here at the University of Utah, that policymakers like you can connect with and understand Absolutely. The international landscape. I mean, it's just a great benefit of one of the many benefits of having a research university right here.
Yep. I'm with you.
This is kind of to put, I would say, the United States maybe in its historical context against some of the other international countries, maybe Europe in particular, and, you know, like the socialism concepts in Sweden and so on, where here in America, it was built with the idea that individual freedom was like the ultimate here. And people came from Europe to get away from I couldn't rise any further than who my father was, or couldn't get any better because of these caste structures or kind of social structures. And in America, you were allowed to come and be nothing and become something. Andrew Carnegie's, you know, just make all kinds of money and so on. And so there was almost no ceiling of what you could do here. But what kind of comes with it is there's no bottom as to how far you could fall either. Whereas some of the European countries were like, well, let's put some ceilings on the top, but we'll also put some floors on the bottom and so on. And so you still kind of have that concept alive and well here in the United States, where, you know, there's a price to ultimately being able to reach whatever level you want by, you know, there's also the possibility of, you know, struggling and so on. And to some degree, we might accept that range a little bit more than what other countries might do and so on. So if you do see those kind of differences between maybe Europe in particular, some countries in Europe and the United States model, I think it has a deep-rooted philosophical foundation.
And an ideological and political foundation too, to some degree. You've seen Republicans and Democrats sort of on that spectrum that you've just alluded to, Mark.
That was Mark Nold, chief economist at the Utah Department of Workforce Services, and Representative Brian King, House Minority Leader in the Utah Legislature. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this final segment, the panel takes questions from the audience. Once more, here's your moderator, Representative Brian King.
Okay, I'm going to turn the time over to you for questions of our panel members. Yes.
My question for you is that with relative to the chart that Mark showed with the in 2019 dollars the real wage rate decreasing, could the lack of negative externalities theoretically predicted be due in part to the fact that it hasn't really been increasing?
Yes, certainly in theory. So you're right that we have not really tested the limits of the minimum wage in a historical context in recent decades. I would say, you know, insofar as we know what the effects of the minimum wage were, even when it was at that higher part of the chart in the 1960s, there are studies now that try to estimate the employment effect kind of looking back that far. And they also essentially come to the same conclusion. So you might say, okay, well, we've really never tested the limits here because even when the federal minimum wage was at its most biting in the sense of how much it could buy you as a worker, that was still not disemploying workers. So there was still some margin there. I would say to interpret that, you know, it's important to take a lens to shed a light, I would say, is the right metaphor, on how labor markets actually function. And if workers are having their wages suppressed by their employers kind of as a regular basis, then the minimum wage will not necessarily have a disemployment effect until the wage reaches and then exceeds the productivity of workers and how much they're worth to their bosses. So as long as you're below that, the effect of the minimum wage should not be to disemploy workers. And you could say, okay, well, we've never seen a disemployment effect in the whole history of the federal minimum wage. Maybe that's because it was never pushed up to the level that was equal to what workers were producing.
Other questions? Yes.
Hi, my question is just what's the effect of raising the minimum wage on undocumented immigrants? Or like, that's just generally for everyone.
Great question.
So, I mean, I guess I'll just jump in and say we would assume that undocumented labor would be more susceptible to some of this exploitation that my colleague's been talking about. And so when we talk about the fact that, you know, it sounds like enforcement of the minimum wage is not necessarily rigorous to begin with, I'm not sure that it would necessarily have a large impact there. So that's what you think about. What's your policy intervention? Do you have thoughts on that, Mark? Mark thinks about this probably more. No?
Not particularly. Undocumented largely means they're not blatantly seen in the labor market, or even undocumented can also be falsely documented and so on. And if you do have some documentation and you do get into the labor force and so on, well, then you're obviously going to be subject, you should be anyway, to the minimum wage laws and so on, because the Fair Labor Standards Act is the federal law that says, hey, you got to adhere to these certain standards, and one of them are minimum wage levels and so on. But you know, how certain industries might still be able to get away with bringing in undocumented labor and using it and so on. But I know they've been making a lot of efforts or trying much harder to, you know, put penalties on employers for discouraging them for going down that kind of road.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
Yeah. I know you guys said it's like really hard to find the effects of minimum wage on like housing and things like that. And the argument I've always heard against minimum wage is like, raise minimum wage and then cost of living will just go like right along with it to kind of mitigate that effect. Is that true? Is there any studies on general cost of living or?
I don't think that there is enough to really make a definitive statement that that's false, but I would be surprised if it's true, or at least, you know, fully true. As I was saying, you know, the minimum wage affects a fairly small set of workers, and even when the increases are substantial, most people in their context in which their consumers are competing against lots of other would-be consumers. And so I don't think that, you know, that you would necessarily see an overall across the board increase in cost of living as a result of some small subset of consumers now having a higher income.
Yeah. You can kind of take the theory behind it and apply it. Again, it's, you know, maybe not broad spread, but think about, you know, when you go to McDonald's and you buy a hamburger, like what's the cost of the hamburger? So there's labor in that hamburger. There's the meat in the hamburger. I don't know if McDonald's has meat in it, but, you know, there's whatever is in the hamburger costs you money. And that's like how you get to the price of a hamburger. And, you know, we assume that the labor that's associated with, right, is enough that it's all equivalent. And so if you were to increase the minimum wage up to some certain level, it's probably reasonable to expect that that hamburger is going to go up in price. But again, across the board, we've not necessarily seen any research that would suggest that.
It depends, I would say, on the environment that it happens within. And here's what I mean by this. The theory says, or that when you raise wages, that more than likely, if the employers can't absorb it in their cost or production, or you're not more productive, they're going to pass the cost on to the consumer. That means inflation goes up, and you just start a cycle that's going on. In this current environment, we're seeing wages going up finally, like the textbook said they should, when unemployment's at 3% or even lower. And yet here's inflation at 1.7% or just somewhere near 2%. And it's just not translating out into wage inflation is making consumer inflation. And if you are in an environment where that is happening, that's, again, the best time to raise that minimum wage, because the market has already factored it in and is not passing it on or says, I can absorb it. It's okay to do that. As I was looking at these various states, one of the many things that many states have a cost of living increase built right into their minimum wage laws. And I was sitting there thinking, wait a minute, if you get into an environment where all wage increases are going right to consumers, and wages go up 3.7%, and next year you force it 3.7 again because the law says it, because all of that was passed to consumers in inflation, then you're 3.7-ing every year just because inflation is being completely passed on. Wage inflation is being completely passed on to the consumers. And so I was sitting there thinking, that could, at some point in time, when all of your inflation is very much being driven by wage inflation, you can get into a bad cycle. But in this current environment where, you know, the wage gains here in Utah, they were 4.2% last year. We're anticipating something like 3.7 this year. And yet overall inflation is 1.7 or, you know, maybe 2 if it, you know, and so on. The business community is currently absorbing that wage increase, whether it's lower profits, whether they're trying to make some seeing productivity gains come with it. Maybe they're subtle, even in this hyper tight labor market, even if there is some substitution of capital or labor for capital, some robotics or automation and so on. In this current environment, we're just not seeing hard wage gains being translated into inflation gains. But in some environments, they're very much together, and that's when you could get what you're talking about.
To close off this discussion, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board just made a comment about this the other day that I thought was interesting. He was asked, they lowered interest rates a couple of days ago, and the question was, well, wages are going up finally. You know, doesn't that raise your concern that there's going to be inflation? And then, so if that's true, why are we lowering interest rates? And he said, you know, there's a lot of ground for workers in this country to make up. They had stagnant wages for a long time after the Great Recession, and what that meant was that the overall labor share of national income went down, and all of the growth that we experienced for, you know, a good many years was allocated to people who don't work for a living. And his interpretation in response to that question was there's a lot more ground to make up in terms of returning the labor share back to what it was at least before the recession, before we get into this question of, sort of the pass-through of higher wages to a wage price spiral type dynamic.
Mark, I wanted to ask you, one of the things that the chart shows, it's not up now, but I can see it on this, that you have some of these states that have indexed over time the wage based on inflation up to $15. Is $15 a cap for that indexing, or is it just it continues to index for as long as it indexes? Or maybe it varies from state to state, if you know.
Some of the states, any state that you had $15 an hour as a target, that was the end of where it was going to. They were working their way to $15
So once they hit the 15, they were not indexing
beyond
that.
They weren't, and in these states, the states that were going to 15 weren't even doing it on the rate of inflation. They said we're going to this level at this level this year, this level to get to 15. Some other states had no limit, no 15 is what they were after. Their laws just said, where, you know, where we are right now, every year it's just going to move up with the rate of inflation.
Okay.
So I really didn't see one using the rate of inflation to get to $15 an hour and then stopping.
Okay. Interesting. Question back there. Oh, sorry.
Steve Bannister from the Department of Economics. For Mark and everyone else, on your first slide you put up with all the states, look like a number of our neighboring states have substantially high and increasing wage rates compared to Utah. I don't know about the actual, but at least the minimum level. And with our very low level of unemployment here, 3% is it? Which is great, but is there any, has anyone noticed any data saying workers are leaving here to go there for the higher wages?
No, in fact, it's the other way. Yeah. And it's not because of wages or anything. We are getting this in-migration that's coming in. And, you know, you're talking about movement among a group of people who probably don't have the means to move. And so, when you get up into the more, the higher wage levels and so on, they have the means to move. And we have in-migration that's really fueling our strong job growth here in the state of Utah. Obviously, when you had the Great Recession, we lost workers. We were following this and kind of seeing, well, how long is it going to take to reemploy what wasn't employed, what not only lost a job but didn't get one and as they aged into the labor force. And it was about 2016 we were starting to think, hey, you know, I think we've kind of reemployed and Utah's growing at 3-4% job growth and so on. And if we're going to keep this kind of average to above average job growth going on in 17, 18, and 19, we're going to have to start kicking in migration or people are going to have to start. And it did. And it was really interesting to watch, and you can see it in the census numbers and their estimations of in-migration, and so we're definitely a net in-migrator in that regards.
I don't want this to be the last word, so let's make sure that we do another question. But just this point about the movement of labor, right? So, you know, some conservative economists don't necessarily like the minimum wage, right? Because we assume the market will take care of it and that there's a perfect market. But this point about this low wage, low-skilled worker class, it can't be moving, is not incredibly mobile. They can't move from, one city to another or one neighborhood to another, one company to another in a really easy way. And that, you know, it's market failure. And that's why, again, depending on what you're trying to do, minimum wage might be appropriate for those workers.
I'm wondering if, from what you were saying earlier, if you're suggesting, say, a company like Walmart is they're forced to pay all their workers $15 an hour, are you saying they're just going to accept the fact that they'll make less profits and not raise their goods, or will they raise the price of their goods?
So I know you've got to leave, and so I'll pass it over. But I think that's the whole $15 at Walmart. But I think about Amazon. You know, Seattle, the minimum wage goes to $15. You know, Amazon's going to pay that anyway, because that's kind of that just is how it works out in equilibrium, and they pay that anyway. You know, so when we're talking about minimum wage, it's a relatively small percent of the working population that's making the minimum wage to begin with. I'll throw it over to Marshall.
Yeah, I think basically the answer to your question is yes. So Walmart has, I believe, adopted either an $11 or $12 company minimum wage policy that has taken the form of basically a wage leadership in the markets in which they operate. That is, they're usually the highest paying employer, at least for the types of people that they employ in the places where they employ them. And I believe the evidence of that is that when Walmart does that, other employers raise their wages not to be equal to that, but feel the pressure to increase them.
We're wrapping things up there. If you'd like to hear our other local programming, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.
Share it fairly, don't take a slice of my pie.